You're listening to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. I'll bring you Jesus, the promised Messiah of Judaism, with Roy Shulman.
Hi, this is Roy Shulman, and welcome again to Jesus, the promised Messiah of Judaism, the show on Radio Maria that celebrates the Jewish roots of the Catholic Church, or seen the other way around, that celebrates the fulfillment, the completion, the full realization of all of the promise and potential of Judaism in the Catholic Church and its sacraments. Now, if you were with us last week, you may recall that the show last week sort of revolved around the Second Coming and a few things that we know will precede the Second Coming. One of them is the widespread persecution of Christians. I will just read a verse from the Gospel according to Matthew with respect to that, from Matthew 24, quote, this is Jesus talking about the Second Coming. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and put you to death, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And there's something else we know that is to precede the Second Coming, which is the widespread conversion of the Jews. As Catholics, we know this from the Catechism of the Catholic Church, paragraph 674, says, quote, the glorious Messiah's coming will be suspended at every moment until his recognition by all Israel, which has always been understood to mean that the Second Coming essentially can't happen until there's a widespread conversion of the Jews. And I have spoken in the past on the program how an attempt to exterminate the Jews or eradicate the Jews, such as we saw during the Holocaust, might be seen as part of a diabolical campaign to prevent the Second Coming. And therefore, one could associate reasonably a attempt to eliminate the Jews as also something to precede the Second Coming, a kind of last-ditch attempt to abort it on the part of the enemy of man's salvation, whose game we know will be up when the Second Coming happens. Now, we also talked a little bit in last week's show, not too far, about what we're seeing in the world today. I don't want to call it unprecedented, but it might be unprecedented, but certainly a huge, almost worldwide persecution of the Christians. Christians are, who once were a dominant presence in the Middle East, are in imminent danger of almost disappearing entirely in the Middle East, and there's a lot of Christian persecution in Africa also. We're seeing certainly a lot of rhetoric about killing all the Jews emerging again, not only in the Middle East and most notably, for instance, in Iran and in the Islamic State, but also in many of the capitals of Europe, which now have a rather substantial Islamic presence. And so to talk about these two trends that we're seeing in the world, that is the widespread persecution of Christians and also this imminent, certainly, threat to try to eliminate once again the Jews, has happened in the Holocaust. I have invited on the show someone who may be the, I don't want to say the world's greatest expert, but certainly a very substantial and notable authority on what's happening around the world to Christians and to Jews under the influence of what is politely referred to as radical Islam, and I'll perhaps let him talk more about that. And I do want to have this conversation in the context of, number one, the possibility that it might be related to biblical prophecy about the Second Coming, and certainly, number two, and most importantly, that it be in the context of the need for prayer for Christians who are being persecuted, for Jews, and also for the Muslims themselves. Now, I hate to do this, but I think we may have a technical problem with our guest. So, having given that introduction, perhaps we should go to music for a minute or two while I try to resolve that technical problem.
You're listening to Radio Maria, a Christian voice in your home. We now return to Jesus, the promised Messiah of Judaism, with Roy Shulman.
Hi, I apologize for that interruption, and we're still trying to get the connection with our guest, which I hope is going to happen in a matter of seconds. But until then, let me just give a little bit of example of what I have been referring to in with respect to the threats to exterminate Jews that have reemerged. I don't think it's much of a surprise when it comes from Iran, but a website very closely linked to the Iranian government said very recently, with respect to the Jews, that the opportunity must not be lost to remove, quote, this corrupting material. It is a jurisprudential justification to kill all the Jews and annihilate Israel. And that comes from the Islamic government of Iran, that it is a jurisprudential justification to kill all the Jews. Now, it's not so surprising coming perhaps from Iran, but we see it, for instance, also in the UK and in France. I'll just read some statistics from the UK. The anti-Semitic attacks in the UK currently are the highest level ever recorded. The Community Security Trust recorded 1,168 incidents against Britain's Jewish population in 2014, which was more than double that of the previous year. That compares to 535 in 2013. So, in the UK in July alone of this year, there were more anti-Semitic incidents in 1 month than the previous 6 months put together. Jewish people were directly abused in the street at a rate of more than one a day. And these assaults included a man shouting at a group of Jewish school children who but boarded a bus to London screaming, "Get the Jews off the bus and I'm going to burn the bus." I mean, you can clearly see that there's something very virulent going on here. And France is seeing a huge exodus of Jews in France, actually to Israel, simply to be safe. There are less than 500,000 Jews in France. That's there are actually 475,000 Jews in France. And there were over 50,000 inquiries of Jews in France last year about emigrating to Israel. So that means that more than 1 in 10 Jews in France were actively looking into the possibility of emigrating to Israel. And in fact, in 2015, 15,000, which means 3% of the Jews in France in 1 year, fled, I think it's fair to say, fled to Israel. Although the Jews in France are less than 1% of the country's population, 51% of all racist attacks in France targeted Jews. So they're less than 1% of the population, and yet over half the incidents of racist attacks were targeting Jews. Dirty Jew rang out in the streets, as did death to the Jews and Jews to the gas. So we see this impulse to exterminate the Jews reemerging in Europe. And what could this mean, and where does this come from? I was hoping by now our guest would be on, and I don't think that he has yet been able to establish the connection. So I will just continue on my own, I guess. And so let me just go on about France with a couple of examples. And again, be frank about this. Virtually all of the anti-Semitic attacks on Jews in France and in England, and in Holland for that matter, are coming from the new Muslim population, which is increasingly under the influence of what is perhaps euphemistically referred to as radical Islam. But the stream of Islam, which views the Jews as the eternal enemies of Allah, and that it is, in the words of one imam, well-pleasing to Allah to kill the Jews. We know that the Holocaust was, in some sense, geographically localized. It came from the Third Reich. It came from Germany. And as the Third Reich took over other countries, such as Poland and Italy and France, it was able to extend the extermination of the Jews to those newly conquered territories. But it was still geographically limited to the territories that were under control of the Third Reich. What's so distinctive and in some sense frightening about this new impulse to exterminate the Jews coming from religion is that it's not geographically localized, that it goes wherever the adherence of at least that radical stream of that religion goes, and therefore it can become, frankly, a worldwide threat or attempt to exterminate the Jews rather than one that's geographically localized. And I spent a lot of time in my book, Salvationists from the Jews, trying to paint a picture in which the Holocaust or the Third Reich's determination to exterminate the Jews was a direct expression of the diabolical will in order to try to abort the Second Coming. And I think that is relatively reasonable to see this as a more effective, in some sense, a second attempt to do the same thing, because, as I said, it's not geographically localized. So let me go back to reading a little bit about what's going on in France, and then if the guest still has not been able to establish a telephone connection, I will again take a musical break for another 2 or 3 minutes and try once again to establish the connection. But for the next couple of minutes, let me just go back to France. There were 800, first of all, in the context of France, I hope that most of us are aware of the murderous attack on the Charlie Hebdo newspaper in France, closely linked to a murderous attack on a kosher supermarket in Paris at virtually the first time. But anyway, back to the statistics. How can anyone be allowed? This now I'm reading from a article, actually, in from of all places, Vanity Fair. How can anyone be allowed to paint a swastika on the statue of Marianne, the goddess of French liberty, in the very center of the Place de la République? That was what happened last July when a tall man in a black shirt and keffiyeh leapt to the ledge of Marianne's pedestal and scrawled a black swastika. All around him, thousands of angry demonstrators were swarming the square with fake rockets, Palestinian and Hamas flags, even the black and white banners of ISIS. Here, barely a mile and a half from the Galerie Lafayette, the heart of bourgeois Paris, the chants, Mort aux Juifs, Mort aux Juifs, that is, death to the Jews. It was Saturday, July 26, 2014, and a pro-Palestinian demonstration turned into a day of terror in one of the most fashionable neighborhoods of the cities. There were 851 recorded anti-Semitic incidents in France in 2014, more than doubling the total from 2013. These included attacks in parks, schools attacked, synagogues torched, and assaults on the metro. Now, rather than go on with this now, I will take go to, again, another short musical break, and fervently hope and pray that when I come back, there will be two of us at this end of the microphone, that my guests will be have been able to join us. So with that, let's, with my apologies, go to another musical break. Hello again. This is Roy Shoman, again, with Jesus, the promised Messiah of Judaism. And again, I apologize for technical difficulties, but I do have the guest on the line now, Robert Spencer, a great authority and expert and extremely knowledgeable on what I have been introducing so far in this show, which is the current persecution of Christians around the world and especially in the Middle East, and the emerging threat to the existence of Jews, both in the Middle East, where it was always tenuous, but now throughout much of the rest of the world and Western Europe, which has the part of Western Europe, certainly, that has a large Islamic influence. So now you are there, Bob, no?
Yes, I am. Yes, hello.
So you probably weren't able to hear the first part of the show, were you?
I'm afraid not.
Okay, so I'm very sorry. I was trying to set the stage talking about, basically to bring you on to talk about both the persecution of the Christians and the emerging expression of the intent to eliminate Jews from the world population in the context of course, the rise of, quote, radical, close quote, Islam, and I'll let you address the appropriateness of those air quotes or not. And also in the context of my personal context of the possibility that it might be a fulfillment of prophecy, you know, that refers to the, you know, late in salvation history. For instance, when Jesus said in Matthew 9 that the second coming would be preceded by a widespread persecution of Christians. And in the, all in the context of exhorting our listeners both to know what's going on in the world and also to pray both for these endangered Christian communities and also for perhaps the Jews and perhaps the Second Coming itself. So that's basically a brief synopsis.
Excellent. Well, where would you like to begin then?
Well, what's going on? Does this look apocalyptic to you?
Very much so, yes. Christian communities that go back to the beginning of Christianity have been eradicated, thoroughly eradicated, from their ancient communities, from the places where they've lived for 2,000 years. Most notably, for example, the Archbishop of Mosul in Iraq, where there was a Christian community there going back to the time of the Lord. He said that, I've lost my entire diocese to Islam, and the same thing is going to happen in Europe and America if people don't wake up to what's happening.
Wow. Wow. So do you know what the state of the Chaldean Christians in Iraq were? That's a Catholic rite, right?
Yes, it is.
What state they're in right now?
It's been the Chaldean Catholic Church in Iraq has been thoroughly decimated. There were well over a million Christians in Iraq before the removal of Saddam Hussein for power and the American presence there. Then when the Americans withdrew, and created a vacuum that was filled by Islamic jihadis who meant to enforce Islamic law based on the Quran, the holy book of Islam, that mandates that Christians have a second-class status and be forced to pay a tax to the Muslims and to accept various humiliating and discriminatory regulations as a sign of their submission to the Muslims. The Saddam Hussein regime and others preceding it in Iraq had not enforced these laws because they weren't Islamic State, but the Islamic jihadis who came to power in large areas of Iraq, particularly the Islamic State now, that has enforced these laws anew and demanded the payment of this tax, the jizya that's in the Quran, from the Christians, or killed them, forced them to convert to Islam, and so on. So now about four-fifths or more of the Christians who were in Iraq 10 years ago have now fled the country or have been killed. There's a handful of Christians remaining, and they are paying the tax to the Muslims and accepting this status of dimitude that in mandates that they be humiliated, discriminated against every day as a sign of their having rejected what they consider to be the true faith of Islam.
And that 80% corresponds to what kind of numbers?
There are about 800,000 people who have been killed or displaced, maybe a bit more, closer to a million, I'd say, because it was, the population of Iraq that was Christian was about 1.2, 1.3 million. About 10 years ago, a little bit longer now. And now it's about 200,000 or less. And so, and rapidly diminishing all the time, particularly in the areas where the Islamic State controls, because the Islamic State is directly confronting the Christians and demanding that they return to their second-class status as mandated in the Quran.
Now, you're rarely accused of sugarcoating things, but I think I may accuse you of sugarcoating things a little bit here, because the paying that penalty tax, the jizya, and accepting second-class citizen status, I would argue is not the worst of it, because the overall rightlessness means their property can be taken at will, that they can be abused at will, they can be actually enslaved almost at will by any Muslim, no?
Oh, absolutely, Roy. Yes, you're quite right. And this is very important, that this is what is known as the dhimma, or the contract of protection. But it's rather like the protection that in the movies, or I guess in real life as well, the mafia offers to people that it's victimizing. In other words, it's a threat. It's more of a threat than protection in any genuine sense. It's a threat of violence that is, then the violence is held in abeyance by the paying of the tribute. But even the paying of the tribute does not guarantee that the violence may not recur at some point completely unannounced and unexpectedly if one displeases the masters. And so all the rights that the Christians enjoy in such a state are at the sufferance of the Muslims and can be revoked at any period, at any point, without notice.
I guess there's something that's even a little bit creepier, if my understanding is correct, which is it's not a matter necessarily of the right being revoked as though by a government authority, but basically any Muslim can do anything they want to any Christian with no fear of retribution.
Yeah, and actually this is something that is a cultural hangover in many areas of the Islamic world. For example, I was speaking last year up in California, and there was a Coptic Christian in the audience from Egypt, and she asked me what I thought about day-to-day life in Egypt. And I had to tell her, well, you know, I've never lived in Egypt. I can't really speak about it. And she said, well, do you think that most Muslims are peaceful? And I said, well, certainly most Muslims are not actively waging jihad. And she said, yes, but most Muslims are not peaceful. They routinely harass Christians just on a day-to-day basis. They can go out of their way to slap them if they're in an elevator with them, or to do something of this kind. And the, no legal action is possible or taken. It can be taken because the police are on the side of the Muslims. And it's generally taken as understood, even in Egypt, which is not a Sharia state, that Christians don't really have any rights that Muslims are bound to respect, and that to humiliate Christians is in line with one's divine, one's responsibility before Allah as a Muslim. Because it is the necessity in the world to make sure that the Christians feel their humiliation for having rejected Muhammad.
And so you mentioned Iraq. I assume this obviously must be true in the parts of Syria that the Islamic State has gained control over.
Yes, that's right. There are more Christians in Syria than there were in Iraq when the Islamic State took over, and so they have not been able to assert their the full weight of their authority on the Christians in Syria at this point. However, there are areas of Syria where photographs have been released of Christians paying the jizya, paying the tribute to the Muslims for the right to exist, essentially, and that tenuous existence at best, as we have discussed. And they are attempting, clearly, to ultimately enforce that over all of Syria.
What about turning to Africa, Nigeria, Sudan, and so forth?
Well, what's very interesting about Africa, if particularly Nigeria, is that the Boko Haram group has now allied with the Islamic State and now has renamed itself, as of February 2015, the Islamic State in West Africa. And this is because of the Islamic State, or ISIS, its claim to be the caliphate, the universal government to which Muslims owe allegiance, and over which, then, which transcends any other allegiance they may have on earth. And so this appeal, this claim to be the caliphate, has proven to be very appealing, very attractive to Muslims around the world. 30,000 Muslims have gone from various countries in the world, 100 countries in the world, to join the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. And many existing jihad groups, such as Boko Haram in Nigeria, have pledged allegiance to the Islamic State. And so what you have is a very interesting congruence in that the Nigerian Boko Haram group was kidnapping non-Muslim girls and forcing them into sex slavery at a time before the Islamic State had come onto the come into the international consciousness. And you may recall Michelle Obama employed a hashtag, bring back our girls, to try to draw attention to this practice. And it was considered to be some horrible, barbaric practice that these West Africans were reviving, when actually it was quintessentially Islamic, based on the Quran, based on the example of Muhammad, and not only, of course, ultimately carried out only by Boko Haram, but also by the Islamic State proper in Iraq and Syria, because they all read the same Quran. And so you have the Christians being terrorized, churches being burned, and this sex slavery being practiced on Christian women in Nigeria as well as in Iraq and Syria.
And Pakistan and the Sudan, and I mean, how much of the, I mean, if we want to kind of focus in a way on the persecution of Christians simply for being Christians around the world, you know, how much of the globe does this cover? How much of the population does this cover? How many countries are involved?
Well, when we're speaking generally about equality of rights before the law, for example, there is not a single country that has a majority Muslim population and a Christian minority in which Christians enjoy full equality of rights with Muslims. Not a single country in the world, and not even in secular Turkey, where there are legal restrictions against building a few churches that are based on Islamic law, legal restrictions against Christians proselytizing, also based on Islamic law, where there are no restrictions, of course, on the building of new mosques or on Muslims proselytizing among Christians. And so there is not a single country where that is majority Muslim, where Christians enjoy equal rights. In some countries, because they enforce Islamic law in its fullness, the status of Christians or other non-Muslims is very tenuous, in exactly the same way that we were discussing regarding the reimposition of dhimmitude among the Christians in Iraq, because here again, they all read the same Quran, and they work from the same Islamic law. And so even though in Pakistan there is not an official status of dhimmitude for the Christians, essentially they live the same kind of tenuous, precarious existence at the mercy of their Muslim neighbors, at the mercy of police, downtrodden because Islamic law forbids non-Muslims to hold authority over Muslims. So the colloquial name for Christians in Pakistan is sweepers, as in street sweepers. This is the only kind of job they can get, the lowest, most menial jobs in society that nobody else wants to do. And it's the same thing all over the world. The only places where Christians enjoyed close to equal rights were in areas like Turkey, like Syria, like Saddam Hussein's Iraq, where Islamic law was not enforced. And it was explicitly set aside and Western laws adopted instead. But everywhere where that has been the case, the secularists are in retreat. Certainly in Turkey, where the Erdogan regime clearly wants to restore a caliphate of its own. And, of course, Saddam's gone in Iraq. Assad is on his way out in Syria. And what's replacing them in every case are Islamic rulers who want to oppress the Christians in line with the Islamic principles mandating that oppression.
Well, let me kind of try to underline something, because this is, I mean, you talk about very serious forms of oppression. I just want to add, if my understanding is correct, there are very major countries like Pakistan and areas of Indonesia and so forth, where churches are routinely bombed or burned, where Christians may be stoned to death or legally prosecuted for mentioning Jesus, saying they believe in Jesus, or saying that they don't believe in the Quran, or they don't believe in Islam. I don't want to say over much of the globe, but over populations of hundreds of millions of people.
Yes. Pakistan is the worst of that, because Pakistan has blasphemy laws that are very elastically written and very casually enforced on Christians, such that a simple profession of Christian faith can get one charged with blasphemy. If you have a Muslim who wants to take your property, then he can get you to say that you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and you'll go to prison, and you'd be in fear of death. If you're not going to be executed for blasphemy by the state authority, then you could well be lynched by a mob. And fabricated stories. There was even an incident a few years ago of a retarded girl who was Christian, who was charged with burning a Quran and was in the imminent danger of being killed. And then it was discovered by essentially by accident that an Islamic cleric had burned the Quran to plant the evidence on the girl, because he wanted to get some of the possessions of the family. And the cleric, because this had become public, was arrested and tried for this, but was completely acquitted and exonerated, while the charges against the girl remained, even though it had been the evidence was entirely manufactured and that had been established.
Wow. Let me just repeat that line from Matthew 24. About preceding the second coming from Jesus, then they will deliver you up to tribulation and put you to death, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. Okay, Bob, there's one aspect of this. You know, my parents are German-Jewish Holocaust refugees. That gives me personally the willies, which is that there are some countries which are not Muslim-majority countries, but which have a significant Muslim minority that are beginning to reflect some of this Islamic-based Jew hatred and Christian hatred, I might add.
It's sweeping over Europe with the large and rapidly increasing Muslim populations all over Europe, exacerbated especially by this refugee crisis over the last few months. There has been an ugly rebirth of anti-Semitism in Europe, with Jews in Paris and elsewhere even being afraid to go out of the house and appear in public with any recognizable sign of Judaism. And they have been attacked physically on more than one occasion, and it's almost always Muslims who are attacking them and screaming "Allahu Akbar" and "Kill the Jews" and so on. Just the other day in Paris, there was an incident—not in Paris, but in France, Marseille—there was an incident where a rabbi was attacked and his companion was stabbed by a Muslim screaming exactly that, "Allahu Akbar" and "Kill the Jew" and so on. And this is something that is rooted in Islam. There's no good to be gained from sugarcoating this. The Quran in chapter 5, verse 82, says that the worst enemies of the believers will be the Jews. And in practice, this all too frequently works out to the Muslims being the worst enemies of Jews worldwide, and considering them to be some sort of gargoyles of evil, the way the Nazis portrayed them, because that's how they're portrayed in the Quran as a whole, as schemers, haters of God, people who are trying to obstruct the will of God and the will of the believers, and who are liars and deceivers and schemers and absolutely dishonest and evil in every way. There have been people who were raised Muslim who leave Islam. I am Hirsi Ali among them, who speak about how they, when they left their Muslim country of birth, went to Europe or to America and encountered Jews in the flesh for the first time, were shocked that they were ordinary folks. They were just reasonable human beings and not these monsters that the Quran and Islamic tradition portrays them to be. But we have to be aware that Islam does portray them in this way, because it leads to the death of people. It victimizes people on a massive scale. As a matter of fact, there's a hadith, a tradition of Muhammad, in which Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, is made to say that the end times will not come until Muslims kill Jews, and Jews will hide behind trees, and the trees will cry out, "Oh, Muslim, there's a Jew hiding behind me, come and kill him." Now, you understand it sounds absurd, but if you really think this man is the prophet, and that he is speaking what is the words and the will of the supreme being, then you've just got marching orders. The end times will not come until Muslims kill Jews, which means that Muslims can bring on the end times, can bring on the consummation of all things by killing Jews.
Let me interject a little personal favorite hobby horse, which is, it's very telling to me that as Christianity has the doctrine that the second coming won't happen until there's a widespread conversion of the Jews, Islam has the doctrine that its version of the second coming, the resurrection of the dead, won't happen until there's a widespread extermination of the Jews, which certainly looks like a kind of dark mirror image.
There are a lot of dark mirror images in that regard. For example, the Antichrist, who will wage war against the church and the believers. In Islam, you have Jesus, the Muslim prophet, who will return to earth at the end times and break all the crosses, kill the pigs, and abolish the jizya, which means break all the crosses means, of course, destroy Christianity, and kill the pigs, because, of course, the Christians don't obey the food laws that they ought to be obeying, and abolish the jizya. That's the tax that we were discussing earlier, the tax that the Christians must pay under the rule of Islamic law. So you have the idea of Jesus, the Muslim prophet, coming back and essentially destroying Christianity and killing Christians, which is remarkably like what the Antichrist is going to be doing in the Christian understanding of the end times.
Wow. Can you shed any light? I've heard in Imam's sermons references to the Jews being descendants of apes and pigs. Where does that come from?
That comes from the Quran as well, actually in three places, chapters 2, 63 to 65, 5, 59 to 60, and 7, verse 166. It says that there were Jews who did not obey the Sabbath and did not observe the Sabbath and were transformed by Allah for their disobedience into apes and pigs. And there's quite a bit of discussion in Islamic tradition as to what the parameters of that were, whether in the first place it was literal, and actually most Muslim authorities believe that they were indeed transformed literally into apes and pigs. And then there's discussion as to whether that refers to all Jews who are somehow apes and pigs, even if it might not be visible in an immediate way, or whether it only refers to this particular group. And there is a lot of disagreement about that. But one thing you will find when reading the sermons or watching the sermons of jihad preachers today in mosques, that they will almost invariably refer to Israelis and Jews in general as the apes and pigs or the descendants of apes and pigs, and meaning to connect modern-day Israel in particular to this Quranic punishment of the disobedient Jews.
And can you shed some light on the basically the historical background of Muhammad's distaste or hatred of Jews? And if I'm not mistaken, I think there is a story perhaps in the Quran that a Jewish woman tried to poison him and so forth.
That's not in the Quran. It's in the Hadith, yes, that he was poisoned after the siege of Khaybar. Khaybar was an oasis in Arabia. There were three Jewish tribes in Arabia. In Medina, when Muhammad arrived in Medina at the Hijra, year 622, the Kainuka, Quraiza, and Nadir, he exiled the Kainuka and Nadir and massacred the Quraiza. Then later, he went to Khaybar, where the exiles had settled, and massacred the rest. And so he does not have a very good record in this regard, but it has become exemplary because he is considered to be the perfect man and the model of all human behavior. You find Islamic jihadis today chanting, Khaybar, Khaybar, Ya Yahud, Jaish Muhammad, Ya Yahud, Khaybar, Khaybar, O Jews, the army of Muhammad will return. And I was in New York City a few years back at a pro-Israel demonstration during one of the incursions into Gaza, and there were Palestinian demonstrators across the street chanting Khaybar, Khaybar, and I thought, people don't realize this is a genocidal call. But the animus seems to have come from Muhammad presenting himself as the new prophet in the line of the prophets of the scriptures, and saying that I'm a prophet just like Noah and Abraham and David and so on. And the Jews said, well, you're not Jewish, you can't really be a Jewish prophet, and rejected his prophetic claim, whereupon after he had modeled his religion to some degree after Judaism, adopted the prohibition of pork and a few other things, he turned on them with a great fury and demonized them. And the demonization is all over the Quran and in the stories of his life in particular.
So you don't think I'm paranoid, huh? Thinking that this could be a dangerous future for Jews in Europe.
There's no doubt about that. The rising Muslim populations mean an increasingly precarious existence for Jews in Europe. And the rising Muslim populations in the United States, for that matter, mean the same thing here, ultimately.
So... if you can, I don't want to put you on the spot. How do you see this in the overarching fabric of the economy of salvation, of the history of salvation?
Well, I don't claim to be an expert on eschatology or on the end times at all, but I do think that it's safe to say, Roy, is it not, that there will be time of tribulation, there will be time of great suffering. And people tend to think, especially when I speak to evangelical Christian groups, I find a quietism among them. They say Jesus is going to take care of all this. And I think, well, you know, in the economy of salvation, Jesus allowed half of Christendom, what had been up to that point, half of Christendom, the entire Eastern Empire and the Roman Empire and the Middle East and North Africa, to be overwhelmed by Islam when it had been for 600 years before that Christian land. And so the idea that the United States will be spared or that Jesus will come back and keep us from suffering, I think these things are fond hopes, but they're not based on any sound understanding of either the way of the cross or of eschatology. And so in general, I think that the decline that we're seeing now is only going to get worse, and that that may have an eschatological dimension. I don't know. But certainly complacency and the idea of some divine hand fixing all this, I think, are those things are to be rejected.
Sounds pretty inconsistent with the words of Jesus, who kept saying things like, if they treated me this way, they won't treat you any better, and take up your cross and follow me.
And the time will come when men will kill you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The time will come when men will kill you and think they're offering service to God. That time is upon us.
And again, kind of putting you on the spot, Bob, but tell me some reasonable directions for prayer to kind of that our listeners might want to, you know, kind of adopt a little bit in their personal prayer lives.
Well, I think that we need to adjust our attitudes in regard to Islam. And that after the Second Vatican Council, there has been a general assumption. I find many times when I speak to Catholic audiences and people bring up what the Vatican Council and then the Catechism has said about Muslims, that we worship the same God, as if that's the beginning and the end of all that needs to be said, and somehow excuses us from evangelization and prayer for them and so on. What we have in Islam is certainly without prejudice to what the council said, but there's a great deal more that needs to be said. We have the quintessential example of why it does matter what you believe, and the fashionable indifferentism of today is vividly demonstrated as bankrupt when you look at Islam, because Islam teaches people that it is good and morally upright and pleasing to God to kill, enslave, rape, and so on. And so it teaches people, in other words, that good is evil and evil is good. And you know that it goes back to the prophet Isaiah, right? Woe to those who call evil good and good evil. And as I just mentioned, it's a prophet, it's something that the Lord says also, that the time will come when men will kill you and think they're offering service to God. And so one thing to pray for certainly is the conversion of Muslims, but I would urge people to combine that prayer with action and to go speak to their pastors and try to explain to them that outreach and dialogue is all well and good, but we need to meet also the challenge to the faith that Muslims pose. There is a concerted effort by Muslims in the United States to convert young people to Islam, and many of the jihad leaders and jihad plotters that I have been tracking over the years, I see, oh, he was raised Catholic, and then he became Muslim. And I think, and probably at his church, there wasn't a single, nobody had, it had never occurred to anybody to have a program to counter the Islamic proselytizing efforts, and it would have been considered anti-ecumenical or something of that kind. But, you know, it's astonishing to me when I see that, and I think this is a failing on the part of the church, that we ought to be meeting this challenge. I'm looking right now, I'm in my office, Roy, and I'm looking at a book called Reliance of the Traveler. Reliance of the Traveler is a very illuminating book. It's a classic manual of Islamic law that is endorsed by Al-Azhar in Egypt, which is the foremost authority in Sunni Islam, as being a reliable guide to Sunni Islam, to what Islam is all about. And it's a very chilling book. I mean, it's a legal manual, but if you read it carefully, you see that it endorses the jihad warfare against unbelievers, the subjugation of Christians, the oppression of women, the war against the Jews. It's all in there. And it was translated by a man named Milhamin Keller, who was a convert from Catholicism, who is a convert from Catholicism. And so that, I think, vividly illustrates the challenge that's before us. And it's a challenge that so far nothing has been done to meet. And so when you ask about what people should pray for, pray also that the churches would wake up to the reality and the magnitude of this threat and start to meet it with coherent and compelling responses to the challenge of Islam.
Amen. And let me just add that I certainly hope that this discussion inspires some listeners to pray for these terribly oppressed Christians around the world, for the preservation of their communities, if that's possible, for the preservation of their faith, for their strength in the face of suffering, that this may all, actually, I hate to say it, but serve for the greater glory of God. Pray and work that countries that are still in a position to might be a little bit more generous in offering shelter to these persecuted Christians, because that's another dimension that we haven't talked about. But it's not as though the Western countries are bending over backwards to provide a refuge for these Christian communities that are literally in danger of extermination in Africa or in the Middle East. And the bottom line is that nothing works without Jesus, whether you're Muslim or Jewish or Catholic, and that we have to pray for the conversion of everybody, including cradle Catholics, but also including Jews and Muslims, and maybe even pray that the church should get a fire lit in her belly once again to evangelize, because I think behind some of what you were saying, Bob, is that the church has gotten very shy about actually preaching the gospel and firmly asserting that everybody needs Christianity.
Yes, exactly. And the thing is that there are young people all over, right around, right among us, who are looking for some meaning to their lives and are not finding it in shallow secularism and materialism. And the Islamic preachers are appealing to those young people and are converting them. And here we have something that could very well be just as appealing or more, or should be, to these people. And it's not being presented properly. It's not being, I think, lived out fully by all of us. And that's a challenge to all of us, really.
That's right, because the watered-down, if you excuse the expression, Church of Nice Christianity isn't going to do it. The real thing is going to do it.
And far too often, and I'm glad you used the term, because people confuse being charitable with being nice. And they think, when I speak about these unpleasant aspects of Islam, that it's not charitable. But actually, remember that it's always charitable to speak the truth. It's never charitable to cover up the truth or to deliberately conceal it and mislead people. And so it's a misunderstanding, a terrible misunderstanding people have that it's good to people to conceal unpleasant truths.
I come not to bring peace but the sword, I think somebody said.
There you go. Yeah.
We only have a couple of minutes left on the show. I do want to promote a little bit. I mean, people, listeners may be interested. I hope they are interested. I think you can probably refer them to a couple of websites where they might be able to educate themselves more and inform themselves about these things.
Well, of course, I have a website, jihadwatch.org, and that is at jihadwatch.org, updated many times daily with news and commentary about jihad activity in the United States and around the world. Another very good website for exactly that kind of thing is my colleague Pamela Geller's site, PamelaGeller.com. And there's another good reference site, TheReligionOfPeace.com. It's The Religion of Peace. Be sure to leave the on, because if you take it off, you'll just get to a jihad site. But TheReligionOfPeace.com chronicles the jihad attacks around the world. It's got a full list of the 25,000 jihad attacks around the world that have occurred since 9/11. Very eye-opening. Okay. And so those are three to start with.
Well, I want to thank you very much. I apologize for the technical difficulties, and I want to thank you very much for joining us. And I do want to make this an Oreo cookie, you know, with an exhortation to prayer on both ends. This has been a rather grim discussion, but we know a number of things. We know that, you know, God is sovereign, and we know that nothing happens that falls outside of divine providence, and we know that our job is to grow in holiness and to help people and to pray, and not to worry. So I hope that this show was an exhortation, help people understand what's going on in the world in the context of salvation history, and also served as an exhortation for prayer, and specifically for Christian and Catholic prayer. So with that, I'm afraid I'm going to have to sign off for today. This is Roy Shoman. You've been listening to Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism, on Radio Maria. And I hope you check out Bob's website, jihadwatch.org. And I hope you join us again next week for Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism on Radio Maria. Bye for now.